first type, the Buddhist, non-Buddhist contemplation, the peaceful and coarse levels, is as you're pursuing the absorptions, you're doing a process of looking at that state of mind and seeing what part of it is more coarse than what other parts of that experience. And which sounds a little bit odd. I mean, you're in an absorption state, so how can there be like coarse parts to it? But there's different factors that one experiences in each of those stages of the absorptions. And it starts out with like five mental factors that include physical sensation of happiness or joy or bliss, mental sensation of joy, happiness or bliss. It involves, let's see, the other factors are concentration, are called applied applied attention, where the mind is brought forcibly to the object, and then the term I think is repeated concentration, where as the mind drifts, it's brought back by another factor. And then the fifth factor is equanimity, just total stability. And as you go through the progression, one by in each of the four absorptions, one of the factors departs, is let go of. And those are considered more coarse factors until you're left with just equanimity as the main factor of absorption at the fourth stage. And so to do that involves an analysis, an investigation that is a type of vipassana. And that's what's being referred to here. And they call it non-Buddhists because non-Buddhists do the absorption states. And they only do the absorption states. So it actually applies to both Buddhists and non-Buddhists, but it's the only one that non-Buddhists do.
And then do they have the same common vocabulary about like that would be, factors and stuff?
That would be a really interesting thing to see.
Because if they agree it's kind of the same states, there's got to be some similar...
Yeah.
Okay, but that's a side.
No, that's a really good point. You know, we should. It would take looking at the Hindu, the existing Hindu sources. The presumption is that the Buddha studied with these non-Buddhist teachers, and those traditions became what we now call Hinduism, and those people were practicing these absorptions. And had this, and he learned this terminology from them. But it would be, as you're saying, it'd be really interesting to see if those now called Hindu traditions have this terminology. Do they have a system of four or five absorptions? Do they have those mental factors? Do they describe the process of going from one to the other in the same way? Who knows? That would be interesting, but I don't know. And then we have two Buddhist versions. We have the so-called Hinayana version, Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddhas. Contemplation of the Four Noble Truths and their attributes. So Vipassana here is contemplating the Four Noble Truths. What are the Four Noble Truths? What's the second truth?
They are things.
Right. What's the third Noble Truth?
Cessation.
Cessation. What's the first Noble Truth?
Suffering.
And what's the fourth?
The path.
Cool. So contemplating those, and they each traditionally have how many aspects? Each of them has four aspects, right? So it maps into 16 aspects. What are the four aspects of the first Noble Truth? Suffering.
You apply each one of the truths.
That's making it. It's the four marks. The three marks made into four. They Zeppo, I think. And so. Groucho Harpo. But their last name isn't Marx. Shravakas and Pratyekas. So here Vipassana is not panoramic awareness. Vipassana is investigating suffering, investigating the origin of suffering, investigating the path. That seems rather different than panoramic awareness. Then there's the the Paramita Yana. So which Yana has paramitas? The Mahayana. It's contemplation of emptiness. So this is the Bodhisattva's practice of Vipassana. And then it's given as part of the same type. So there's not really four, but you could say there's four. There's in the Vajrayana or Matrayana, there's the contemplation of emptiness that's taught to be endowed with bliss. So in Vajrayana, the skillful means is using the experience of bliss or joy to understand emptiness, to create the intensity of experience to understand emptiness.
Has anyone ever talked about the bliss jhana as it relates to the bliss of the Vajrayana emptiness, Vipassana?
I think they distinguish it.
Do you know on what basis?
Well, see,
the wisdom.
Well, the bliss in the jhanas falls away after the second or third jhana,
right?
And the bliss in the Vajrayana like increases.
So you should practice Vajrayana.
Yeah, hey, it's a choice.
So what's the difference between emptiness and the four truths?
What's
so that's the object of Vipassana in each of those two traditions. So the Four Noble Truths maps out the arising of samsara and the nature of samsara, the arising of it, the nature of nirvana, and the arising of it. And emptiness is the nature of
reality.
Nirvana, right? One of those.
Mm-hmm.
Both.
Both of those?
Both.
Okay. The common preparatory stages are similar to those of the mundane path, which is the first type. However, those who have entered the Matryana and the others do not strive for them. So here's a statement that says, if you do, if you enter the Paramitayana version of Vipassana or the Matryana, you don't strive to do the contemplation of the peaceful and coarse levels. If you do the Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddhist contemplation of the Four Truths, you may do that that activity. Not an important little point. But anyway, the classification in terms of types are mundane Vipassana, which suppresses evident afflictions. So here we have Kongchul's commentary to his root verses, where he gives a little bit more explanation. So mundane Vipassana suppresses evident afflictions. To go from one jnana to another, you have to suppress afflictions, and it consists in contemplating what aspects of the an absorption state are higher and which are lower, and then suppressing the lower aspects in order to achieve higher states of absorption. The Shravakas, Pratyekas, Buddhas, the Four Noble Truths, the 16 attributes, we talked about that. We talked about these. So the latter three types are super mundane Vipassana. Super mundane means
above mundane.
Above mundane, because
it's ultimately
because
it's not provisional.
Because they lead to
enlightenment.
Thank you. Which completely eradicates afflictions. The way to accomplish, so the implication is the absorptions do not eradicate afflictions and do not lead to enlightenment necessarily. The way to accomplish the actual concentrations, which is common to both systems, that first type, by means of the seven preparatory stages, of which the first is shamatha, has been described in the chapter dealing with the mundane path in the book prior, the chapter prior. However, those who have entered the mantrana and so forth do not particularly strive for those stages. Then we have a classification according to the essential nature. Just the front. on one a little bit. Thanks. Yeah.
It's that there is no suffering and there is no cessation of suffering and there is no path.
That's good. Yeah. That's the relationship, right?
Yeah.
Thank you. So here we have an explanation of Vipassana, not in terms of its types, but in terms of its experience or how it's practiced. And here we have three different versions. The first one is that there's four types of Vipassana. Vipassana is of four... The practice of Vipassana involves four types of activities. The translation is a little bit confusing because the word type keeps getting used. But there's four activities. In one scheme of Vipassana, there's four activities that are applied in investigating the essence. Investigating the essence is understanding emptiness, understanding and these are called discriminating, fully discriminating, examining, and analyzing. The second is that there's three gateways or three avenues or three stages, again, in understanding or experiencing of Vipassana. Designations in, more accurately, exploring designations, and then thoroughly investigating experience or phenomena, and then individually analyzing phenomena. And then there's six investigations: meaning, thing, character, direction, time, and reasoning. And the latter has four types. And through these six, discrimination is applied by this investigation to each and every phenomena from form up to omniscience. So Vipassana is an exploration, investigation of the nature of all phenomena in order to understand suchness. What is mainly taught here is not the Vipassana of the higher levels and paths, but the Vipassana to be practiced by folks like us. There are three main types of classification. First, according to the sutra, unraveling the thought, there's a classification known as the four types of Vipassana, which investigate the essence, suchness. These are blah, blah, blah. Each of which is these two, discriminating, and then fully discriminating, each of which is divided into thoroughly examining and analyzing. So there's two types of activities and they have two grades of intensity. The two types of activities, and again, the terminology is a little difficult because the word discriminating is used basically twice, but there's a different type of discriminating being implied. And then the first discriminating has two levels, thoroughly examining and analyzing, and the second one has the fully discriminating, also has two levels of intensity. Discriminating involves focusing on the varieties of phenomena, the relative truth, distinguishing them into categories such as aggregates, elements, or dhatus and ayatanas, the three skills, and proceeding to a detailed subdivision of each. Fully discriminating involves focusing on their mode of being and realizing the absence of a self of persons and phenomena. So these are two different activities. The first one is discriminating, categorizing our experience and phenomena into different types of phenomena. So working against the main strategy the process of the development of ego uses, or the belief in a self uses, is that it believes that there's a continuum of experience, that there's a unitary quality to experience, that there's a oneness, that there's a oneness of the perceiver, and there's a oneness of the object, that they're objects that are wholes, in the sense of W-H-O-L-E-S, There's a whole cushion, there's a whole table, there's a whole chair, there's a whole wall, there's a whole person. And so the first part is discriminating, breaking down things into parts, and seeing that the whole person is a fiction. A whole person is made up of a whole bunch of different parts and so forth. And then there's fully discriminating, involves focusing on their modes of being and realizing the absence of a self. So after breaking things down, then we look at in what way can we talk about those things as existing or not existing, or having an essence or not. And there's two broad categories that we make of types of things in the world. One is the presumption that there's an owner to an assemblage of a living being called a person, and the other is that there's an essence to inanimate phenomena, such as rocks and walls and trees, and well, those are animate.
But wait a minute.
Yeah, really.
From the view of the self, aren't animals and organic things also?
They have persons. Well, sentient beings have persons. Non-sentient beings in the Buddhist tradition don't have persons.
But I mean,
and you might
not
feel upset about that. But
we're just talking about humans, but from humans' point of view, also dogs and cats are phenomena. There's something, they're other.
They are
just
other.
Just like a rock or a tree is
other. They are other.
They're a different kind of other.
I mean, just that you can take them as an outer object.
Yes, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, so they're outer. And we saw that in the stages of Vipassana, where there's basically like the outer world. And there it's anything that's outside myself.
So in one sense there's self and other, but on the other hand there's animate entities, seeming entities.
We project, like,
inanimate.
On your dog, you project that there's like something, some coordinating entity in the dog.
That's true.
That makes your dog your dog, and it's still... Right. 10 years later, it's still the same dog. We put
it. Little chewing the bark.
And so then examining and analyzing refers to coarse and subtle aspects of these two types of activity. So just a greater, lesser version of each, and then a greater version of each.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Going back up to the part that's in bold, the three bullets about the classification, and the very last line where it says we apply to each and every phenomena from form up to omniscience. Is that phrase from form up to omniscience referring to a specific categorization scheme, like the one of the charts that we use?
Yeah, the dharmas.
All the dharmas.
Yeah, okay. 75 or 100 right. Dharmas that goes from form to omniscience.
Right.
Totally. And so if you have the chart of meditation handy, you'll see that we mapped this, that Pete here took this text, this chapter, and mapped it into this chart here. And it might be a helpful way to begin to understand what he's presenting, these different ways of experiencing Vipassana.
So is that what the sheet, what is the sheet 5, sheet?
Is it all of you or the other side?
Like, sorry.
Yeah, this side. Does it say sheet 5?
Yeah, it says like sheet 5 in parentheses at the bottom. Sheet
oh,
eight,
yeah, this is the top sheet of a pack of slides that includes 10 pages. And period just said,
well, so those sheets don't, we don't have those sheets.
They don't exist.
Okay.
But they appear.
Oh.
But we'd be happy to circulate this to you. Didn't want to like overwhelm you with paper and stuff, but Peter and I would be happy to share something that we spent many hours
on. Is it like an electronic package, or is it each one is separate?
These are all probably on the website.
No, they're all. Yeah, they're all electronic.
Oh, I know, we still have.
Yeah, we'll circulate the electronical. So you see, under Vipassana, there's the first division. It's analytical and resting. So we're on analytical Vipassana, even though he didn't really explain that yet, which we'll come back to. But under analytical, there's these two major activities, discriminating, which is focusing on the varieties of phenomena, and then there's fully discriminating, which is focusing on their mode of being. Are they empty or not? Right? And so that on the left-hand side, focusing on the varieties of phenomena, we have examining, distinguishing into categories. So that's the sort of less intense, you know, stage one is the aggregates, ayatanas, and dhatus. And then analyzing is proceeding to a detailed subdivision of each. And that's a more extensive system that's elaborated well in what's called the collective topic system, where you have classifications of objects and subjects and so forth. And then we have, on the other hand, focusing on the mode of being, we have examining the self of persons to understand their selflessness. And then we have on the right understanding the selflessness of phenomena.
Persons is
three. To come back to the text, we're on the bottom of page 49 of our source book. And he says, the way of examining is described in the Sutra Unraveling the Thought as fully examining definitely, fully understanding it closely. This also applies to analyzing. Thus, the extensive classification includes 16 divisions, and this presentation can be found in this text, The Level of Fear. So this is just an alternative division that has more detail to it. And then on the next page, a classification similar to the one given in that sutra was given in this text, the Compendium of Knowledge, which is Abhidharma Samuchaya by Asanga. He says, what is Vipassana? It's discriminating, blah, blah, blah. It is the remedy to rigidity and conceptuality. So rigidity, we normally think of like as a physical term. But for them, this is a clunky translation of mental rigidity, where you think you know what's right, you think you know what's going on, you think the world exists in the way that you perceive it, or that the way you interpret your perceptions.
It's not just a physical thing, too, though. You know, there's a certain way of holding yourself. And
it can be.
Stable,
it
know?
Can be, but... But the
you can spot them on the street, you know, where they walk.
They do tend to come together. They are affiliated. But not necessarily. There's a lot of, you know, people who are very loosey-goosey that have just this rigid, you know, view of the way things should be and so forth.
So is that the term of Shinjan or suppleness or whatever?
It's the opposite of rigidity.
It's the mental suppleness.
Right. And that draws the mind away from the erroneous and settles it in that which is not erroneous, is what Vipassana does. Let's see. So then there's secondly this other classification of Vipassana known as the three gateways. And he has the quote, and then he explains that if one identifies those three in relation to meditation on selflessness, they are involved and focuses on the recognition of it, selflessness concentrating on its attributes without making much use of logical argumentation. So they're giving a little example. And in the quote just above that I skipped by the Buddha, he says, Maitreya, there are three. The one arising from designation. So that's this one. First we focus on the designations of a phenomenon. Here we're looking at the self. And we look at what are the attributes of the self in order to recognize selflessness. And then secondly, the Buddha said, the one arising from thorough investigation, and here the example is one uses reasoning in order to ascertain what one formerly could not understand. So that indicates that it's a process of logical reasoning. Inference, using the conceptual mind, investigation. And then the Buddha says the one arising from individual analysis, one analyzes repeatedly as before the meaning which has been ascertained. So then one repeats this analysis, this process of first picking up the general characteristics of a phenomenon, and then secondly analyzing it in great detail, and then one repeats that over again. Goes back to the general characteristics of it and then analyzes it, or goes to a different object.
So
as being three gateways to understanding emptiness, to experience Vipassana, which is similar to the instructions that we have received on how to do contemplation practice. Finally, there's this sixfold classification known as the six investigations. And this could take a very long time to go through, or just to go through simply or more quickly. Let's see. Investigation of meaning entails finding out the sense of a given word or phrase, going from the words to the meaning, just like in the famous experience of Vishmahasiddha, where he was accosted by a beautiful woman of a certain type, or a beautiful example of a certain type of woman.
Naropa.
What was it?
Naropa,
yes. Or he's visited by the
hack.
The prototypical hag. That possessed the 36 forms of hagness. She was a beautiful specimen of a hag. She had the 36 type of aspects of hagness.
Perfect
hag. That's what they said. Anyway, he goes, there's this distinction between the words and the sense and the meaning. The investigation of things, classifying them as internal or external, as Mr. Sarfati earlier explained to us. Investigation of character entails identifying this classification of phenomena as being either general or abstract, means conceptual abstractions, general images, where we have things like a forest is a conceptual construct that we apply when there's a grouping of trees that meets our definition of what a forest is. We all know that a forest as a thing doesn't exist because you can't touch a forest. You can touch a tree. You know, groups, any group of anything is an abstraction, is a generalized phenomenon. And then the interesting thing is that any phenomena is an abstraction, because any phenomena that you can identify is ultimately able to be broken down into what's called specifically characterized phenomena. But it's used in the way of entering you into that whole notion of there being conceptual phenomena, things that live only in our conceptual mind, and things that you can experience through your senses.
That's pretty much it, senses versus mind.
But wait, you said that any phenomena is an abstraction, because you can break it down into something that's
right,
specific.
Right, so sorry?
Well, no, the question I had is that, but isn't anything that you break it down into also another abstraction at another level?
Yeah. That's what I was saying. Yeah.
Okay. So you really
odd infinitum.
You can't touch a tree. Touch wood, and you can't touch wood.
Well, that's what I meant. You made it sound like the specifics were actually specifics, but they're still
right.
General.
Right. So it's the identification of specific phenomena pushes you into a series of realizations of each layer becomes a generalized phenomenon. One by one, you realize when you try to touch the tree, you're touching the bark, and the bark is particles of wood, and that's, you can't ever find the thing. And you realize that we have layers of things, of thingness in our mind that are all abstractions. So then it comes back to, well, when you smell a rose, what is that actual experience? And is there some actual experience there that's not a generalized abstraction?
I feel like in this, it's leading us like a carrot towards suchness,
yes,
rather than just emptiness, which is sort of like because we're so engrossed in, well, something's happening, it feels like that's like, we just keep, this feels like suchness.
Yes, yeah, there's an experience.
There is some concrete something. There's some.
I don't know about that.
No, there isn't. But there isn't, but it keeps leading you towards, like, there's...
It's not nothing.
This, yeah. It just reminded me of what you said a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
The difference.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it also, like, pulls you into your experience rather than just, like, shrugging it off. Like you're constantly like looking and like borrowing.
Analyzing, further and further analyzing.
Rather than the essence of your experience, which is itself
the fiction.
The fiction of emptiness.
Let's see. Investigation of direction means what is wholesome. So the directions here are either you go towards nirvana or towards samsara. It's basically those two directions.
Like the meeting where they basically refer to it as like black or whatever. It's just like
you could affiliate it with colors if you wish, but it doesn't have to be. Investigation of times entails considering what's happened in the past, present, and future. So understanding causality, the progression of the three times. And then reasoning takes us into the realm of valid cognition and logic. And it goes through the three different types of arguments that create valid propositions. And I'll skip that part and suggest that instead you take the class that'll be offered later on that topic. And then he says on the next page, by means of these, one discriminates and comprehends each and every phenomena from form up to omniscience, whether afflicted or pure. And then he says, these six investigations should be known as three. You should summarize them into the meaning, the mode of being, and the varieties. He doesn't really explain what that means. Let's see. Yes, so down the next thing he says, six investigations should be known as three, and then Vipassana should also be condensed into preparatory or analytical and actual or unfluctuating. And so we call these analytical or non-analytical Vipassana, or analytical and resting Vipassana. And let's see, in a little bit, he'll talk a little bit about those. But first, he says the sixfold presentation can be condensed into these three categories. And he says the first of these corresponds to the first of the six investigations, the second to the things in general, etc. So he does a little mapping of how those three line up to the six, which you can do it in your leisure if you have such a thing. And the three gateways are the entrances to the... So here he links them all together. He's giving you these three disparate ways of practicing Vipassana. Here he tries to link them together. The three gateways are the entrances to the four Vipassanas, explained at first, and the method of investigation was presented as six. The method of investigation is one of the three gateways, right? Therefore, the three gateways and the six investigations are included in the four Vipassanas, which is why... So he is implying that the four-part Vipassana that he presented earlier is the main categorization. And that's what you see mapped on this chart. Because he concludes that the main categorization is the four, so that's what we use. Vipassana can also be condensed into preparatory or analytical, and actual or non-fluctuating. So analytical Vipassana is seen as the cultivation towards actual Vipassana, which is immovability, non-fluctuating. Okay, so enough of that, enough of the categories. How do we actually freaking meditate? After our minds are like categoried up. The way to meditate is to analyze such selflessness by means of prajna, superior knowledge, and then to rest in a state free from mental fabrications. Here's the most interesting phrase in the whole text. Non-conceptual images are the basis for analysis. Having identified the particular object, one cuts through misconceptions regarding its qualities. So, non-conceptual images. Let's go back to general and specifically characterized phenomena, which I just tried to explain using the example of a forest as a generally characterized phenomenon. Would a generally characterized Would a forest be a non-conceptual image? Right. So forest is a conceptual image. What's an example of a non-conceptual image?
Oh. Or in an airplane, you see the forest?
It's the forest
it's still
free of labeling.
Is it still?
It's the forest free of labeling.
It's the color, the form.
Green.
Okay, and we're in meditation, remember. So what's one of the, what's a common non-conceptual image in meditation practice?
The breath.
The breath. The posture. The sight or sound or whatever, you know. Aches and pains.
Just senses. Any,
yeah, whatever arises. It's like a very obscure way of saying, you know, whatever. Sensory experiences you have in meditation. Those are the objects for Vipassana. We don't analyze concepts in Vipassana because concepts we know are generally characterized phenomena already. They have a lesser, in the hierarchy of existing things, they're already like down on the list. But we believe that specifically characterized phenomena are real. Those are the things we believe are real, right?
My image, the word image.
Yeah, image, thank you. Image implies visual. And so the translation is not that great to say image, but it's the reflection in the mind of any sense experience.
Okay.
And this goes back to the Buddhist system for how perception happens. Which is that the consciousness is reflexive, passively reflexive, and consciousness changes or morphs or appears in the aspect of the object. So what we experience a sense perception, our consciousness takes on the aspect of that external so-called external object, and we're aware of the consciousness.
Where does Kempo Sultrans, where does this term appearance, where is
appearance is different. Appearance is phenomenon, but he uses, these are his translators, so.
Yeah.
But isn't that similar, though, in a sense that the fact that he's calling it appearance is a little bit similar to the notion of the aspect, isn't it?
Well, then you have to go through what's the appearing object, what's the object of engagement, what's the, that whole system.
Right.
So I'm not sure how you're using appearance.
I guess I'm just saying it's a little bit of a way of softening, stepping back from the notion of that, existing. What's the word that's being translated that you were just describing?
It's probably specifically characterized phenomena.
The image, reframing from images.
It's probably. No, I don't know. Hmm. It's probably Sen Ni. How's that? I don't know if that helps. We can go over it afterwards. So. Having identified the particular object, sorry.
This seems like a similar function to the progress of the jhana states of discarding the coarse for the subtle, in this case with sense perceptions and the accompanying conceptualizations.
Yes, it's pretty much, here though it's a pretty much like one hit or miss thing.
Yeah.
As opposed to like a graded level. But here they're very much so. Of this, coming out of your head, coming out of discursiveness, and just feeling the breath, feeling your posture, experiencing your life, the feeling tone of being alive, the second foundation of the first and second foundation of mindfulness, body and feeling. Having identified that particular object, one then cuts through misconceptions regarding its qualities. So you experience an object such as the breath. And then you go through what are the different misconceptions I have about my body. what are some common misconceptions that we have about our body? Generally, we think it looks better than it is, right? Or that we're skinnier than we are. I don't know. No, that the body is like one whole thing, right? That it's solid, that it's continuous, that sort of thing. If one has no understanding of the view of selflessness, whichever type of meditation one may do will be mistaken with respect to suchness. Therefore, it's necessary to establish the view. On the other hand, even though one may have an intellectual understanding of the view, if one does not rest within that understanding, suchness will not have been meditated upon. So here he's saying, if you just endlessly analyze, you don't ever experience the benefit of the analysis. The benefit of the analysis comes through letting it seep into your inner experience so that it impacts your reflexes, it impacts your preconceptual presumptions and activities. Therefore, one first analyzes selflessness by means of prajna, doing the analytical part, and then one rests within the sphere of complete freedom from mental fabrications. So that's to the extent that you're able to experience some letting go by having contemplated emptiness, then you rest in that. You don't like have this idea, well, I'm going to understand emptiness fully before I ever meditate or rest. But every bit of understanding of emptiness that you have, you then let that seep in. I'm not my hand. I'm not my leg. You know, even to that extent. Furthermore, if the ability to rest in equipoise decreases due to extensive analytical meditation, one should emphasize stabilizing meditation. So if through this process you've analyzed excessively so that you're not able to rest, then you go back to shamatha and re-stabilize with shamatha. And thus restore the abiding aspect. If one loses interest in analysis due to too much stabilizing meditation, one should go back to analytical meditation. If you get sort of bored with the analysis, trying to understand emptiness and just want to have, you know, peaceful shamatha experience, you have to rouse yourself to through the logic of understanding. There's no way to become enlightened just through shamatha practice. The shamatha and vipassana are said to be most effective when practiced equally in this way. The method explained here, namely to analyze the object of meditation by means of discriminated knowledge, and finally to rest in a state free of mental fabrications, is common to all system attendants. Moreover, according to the Geluk tradition, during the actual phase of equipoise, the mode of apprehending the object is repeatedly brought to mind. So there's this subtle argument that's going on between the Galupas and the Kagyus about how to do Vipassana in the sense of what we just went over of, like, at what point do you just rest and let go of the analysis? And the Galupas are very much into like a very brief resting. And they immediately say to repeat the analysis and then rest. But it's like a very momentary resting.
I like the way they slip that in there in a
very
subtle way, you know.
They both do, you know. So if you read Tsongkhapa's version, he has a similar text to this. He says the other thing. He says you have to continue to do the examination, because if you don't continue to sharpen your mind, you won't actually pierce through the belief in a self.
But he doesn't put a little tagline saying,
like those lazy cocks.
Other schools just sit like pigs, you know.
No, he does say that. He says, they all quote Sakyapandita, who totally trashed the Kagyus. Anyway, the actual meditation. Oh, so what was that? I thought that was the meditation. Okay. Jesus, got a sense of humor. When meditating on shamatha, due to the concentration of mind, many images appear, which may or may not be similar to what is found in the external world. You may dream
like
things up. Well, it may be real stuff, or it may be totally made up. So you may have like internal visions of things. These are known as non-analytical images, all of them. In the practice of vipassana as well, such images arise due to the force of shamatha, and are then taken as the basis for individual analysis. Thus, the analysis is not actually directed towards the outside, since the mind is solely turned inward. Turn inward towards whatever images arise in your mind during the shamatha practice, you would then take as an object for analysis in your vipassana meditation. Whether it's a loved one, whether it's an object, whether it's an image of yourself as having a body, possessing a body. When analyzing these images arising out of samadhi, it's necessary to begin by focusing on each object individually with discriminating knowledge. Since without identifying a particular object, it's not possible to cut through misconceptions concerning its qualities. So he's saying here, you don't just like theoretically take all phenomena the way we do when we talk about the three marks of existence, say all phenomena are impermanent, but you actually have to, you know, take a phenomena that we project existence onto. I think we all do. We project that this gong den is here. So you would take the gong den as, you would take your sense input of a gong den. Your non-analytical image of a gong den is the experience of a blue rectangular object. And you would analyze that. So I believe that it exists. I believe the gong den exists. I don't know about you guys, but that for me is a major source of attachment.
So is the analysis, though, in that case, sort of looking at the tendency to reify it?
Yes, totally.
So it's like, you know, blue,
right,
bagel,
so
gondon, oops.
Having identified the object, once cuts through the misconceptions. So what are my misconceptions? My misconceptions are that there's an object, a sense field experience that exists as a package that's a phenomenon, that's a gong den.
Right. So it's that tendency that we are actually analyzing.
To objectify as wholes, continuous, and of a certain type. That, you know, I have this generic image of gong den. And as soon as I look at this, they're joined automatically, subconsciously, in my mind. This automatically becomes one of the set of all gong dens that exist possibly in the world. And I no longer experience this, I experience gong denness. That's the major obstacle to experiencing emptiness. Is that we immediately categorize, labeling, all labeling. Kuntag, when Rinpoche talks about all labeling. That's that process of pigeonholing. Immediately things get pigeonholed based on your prior experience. And no longer have the sense of vibrancy as just sensory phenomena.
And so even if we were to, let's say, be sitting here, and instead of Gondan leaping out at us, it might, you know, we might just be hanging out and sort of like you're thinking blue, or, you know, you're thinking blue cloth. It's still, that's just another layer of reifying in a different line.
Right, so separating the thought blue from the visual sense experience of blue.
Right.
And so trying to find, like, how is that happening? Where is that happening in my mind? Like, where does it arise from?
Mm-hmm.
And some people, some traditions, they'll actually do an analysis of, like, you can question the object. You can say, now, is that blueness, this being a particular member of the set of all blue phenomena, is that coming from you? Are you telling me that you're blue? Or am I, like, projecting the blueness?
Right.
Where is the notion of it being blue coming from? And it's deep in your subconscious. It's not like something you consciously even say that, oh, this matches all blue phenomena, therefore I'm going to exclude all non-blue phenomena. You know.
The tricky part is, let's say, if somebody's scientifically minded, they may bring in the concepts of what has been learned about that.
Right, so you have to examine the conceptualizing process.
Right. So for example, you know, if one doesn't have that, you might just think, okay, it's blue because it's blue. Whereas somebody else that knows the science might think, okay, it's blue because
right.
of the reflection.
Right, it depends on your learning, your predilection, and
right.
condition.
So what's the method for breaking? You recognize that you have this projected, and then what's the method for...
You look at where is that projection coming from? Where is that generalized conceptuality process happening that gives something existence as something? It's like just looking into that process that happens over and over again.
But you don't necessarily like break it down into the dhatus and ayatana.
No, that would be a further level of conceptuality. Right. More just like feeling it, like, and seeing if you can shift. Seeing if you can drop it and just experience the color and then bring up the terminology and see, you know, sort of play with that interplay between the conceptual version of it and the non-conceptual version.
How do you do that with something like fire that's like dangerous if you it's hot, it can burn you. How do you...
Well, you don't put your hands in.
Well, but even if you get too close, you know,
okay.
I mean, that's a
well,
that's
don't
like
get
a
too close to
that's
it.
Like a okay. I mean, that's
like
a,
moving objects, cars, things like that. You know, you want to be careful of that stuff. That's a good point. Yeah.
But the carefulness is another projection. So this is the trick.
Right, but you don't want to like injure yourself while you're challenging your conception. But you,
sort of understanding the usefulness
can,
of
and well, you can almost see it more graphically with something like that because it's like you know it's like where does this knowing come up as I put my hand towards the fire? At what level is it? You know, where does instinct turn into? Or the, just the bare perception of heat turn into conceptuality. Let's see.
It's not a negative thing necessarily. It's just understanding that we're doing it and how we're using it.
Yes, yes. And how we use it to project existence onto things. That's not there. We project a fireness onto fire that's not there. And by fireness, I mean the general notion of the idea of fire. So it's important, you know. So what we're now talking about is what is that general notion of fire? How does it get merged with the actual fire? And how do you separate them? And where's that happen in our mind? Therefore, one begins by clearly bringing to mind the object regarding with which one wishes to eliminate misconceptions and proceeds to examine it through perfect discriminating knowledge, thus ascertaining its lack of inherent existence. Then, grasping the object of samadhi, in this case the non-analytical image, undistractedly, one should realize its being mere appearance, empty of inherent existence. So then having sort of played with this process of conceptualization that gets overlaid and projected, imputed onto the basis of raw sensory experience, then you relax the analysis and just experience the raw, to the extent you can, the raw sensory experience as an example of empty appearance. That appearance is empty of my projection of some existence onto it. The samadhi and superior knowledge are thereby unified, shamatha vipassana, and being focused on the same object. As said in the compendium of knowledge, samadhi and superior knowledge are the same object of observation. The breath, the body. The nature, here's the next root verse, the nature of the percept. What is a percept?
The thing you perceive.
Thank you.
The object of perception.
The object of perception is understood to be empty like space. So that's the outer. That's the first state. The perceiver is examined as to its origin, abiding, shape, and color. Discriminating knowledge itself, then, like a fire produced by rubbing wood, vanishes in the expanse of not finding. And thus one rests free of grasping. So the whole process is one of not being able to find what our mind is automatically projecting thingness, our mind is automatically projecting thingness onto sensory experience. And so by looking at it carefully, you don't find that thing. And then therefore the mind releases from the fixation of belief in that thing when it's done repeatedly and deeply, theoretically. And that's lastly one rests free of grasping.
So that's meditation, post-meditation, right? This description of practicing.
Well, it can be both. It can be both. It can actually be like you can do analytical Vipassana on a cushion, starting with shamatha, and then maybe you have an ache, maybe you have an emotion, maybe you have a memory, maybe there's something vividly, some visual object. Or sound, maybe, you know, there's a loud sound outside that's bothering the heck out of you, you know. And then that can be the object of your Vipassana. And so you can do that on the cushion. And then once you get a feel for that projection process, then yes, you can do that as you walk around. As you go into new situations and you see, oh, I immediately assume what's going on here. When you meet new people, I immediately project my stereotypes onto them, or whatever it is. When resting in equipoise on form, etc., one also realizes its empty nature by means of discriminating knowledge and remains in that state without being attentive to the attributes of the object. So, just what we just said is, once you get some taste of that, you can then experience the sensory quality of it without going to the next step in a structured way. You know, the mind is habituated, and so obviously it takes quite a while. It remains in that state without being attentive to the attributes. One begins by familiarizing oneself with this practice, and as a result one comes to cognize emptiness as if you're suspended in the midst of space. So the normal structures of, oh, we're on the floor, on the sixth floor of a building that's rooted into the ground of New York City and the planet Earth, and, you know, all of that stuff disappears, and the projection of...
You go plummeting into space.
Right. With no reference even to the nature of mere percept. This is the yoga of non-referential percept, and is the external aspect of meditation. Meditation on the inseparability of appearance and emptiness. So you may have heard these from the Mahamudra tradition, where there's a series of four inseparabilities of something and emptiness. And the first one is appearance. The first one is form, which, when understood correctly, is called appearance or mere appearance. The internal aspect refers to the perceiver when, for example, anger arises in consciousness. One should identify it and examine it with discriminating knowledge. First one looks for the cause of its arising, then whether it dwells within or without, where it is. Does it have any shape or color? Finding nothing whatsoever, one rests in equipoise within that understanding. This method is to be applied to whichever of the six root afflictions may arise, as well as to neutral thoughts. In short, whatever type of thought arises, one should be aware of it and meditate as described above. So in addition to sense experiences, you do this Vipassana practice with your thoughts, emotions, memories, whatever. This is the yoga of non-referential perceiver instead of non-referential percept, and is the internal meditation instead of external on awareness and emptiness as inseparable. Finally, the object examined and the discriminating knowledge itself, just as a fire produced by rubbing wood together, both vanish in the sphere of not being found. But here, one, having understood the emptiness of the perceiver, one is still left with this feeling of doing something, that of understanding emptiness. And so then you look at that sense of there being a doer or an understander or an understanding and dissolve that. At that point, one rests in a state free of grasping, the last stage. Then he quotes the Tisha's famous text, which many of us have seen a number of times. Let's see. Thus, the mind of the past has ceased altogether. The mind of the future not yet arisen. The present mind is difficult to examine. This is because, just like space, it has neither shape nor color, and therefore it cannot be established as truly existent. So the ultimate practice is examining your own mind and looking for where your mind is and how we project an experience onto our mind. And see, just like we talked about sensations, projecting blueness or form onto perceptions. In the same way, looking at your own mind and see how we project it being somewhere. We project the sense of there being an awareness, of there being something that's being aware. And therefore, it cannot be established as truly existent. Alternatively, this lack of true existence can be proven by reasons. So, the more extensive analytical phase that's done outside of meditation is using the various arguments of the Madhyamaka logic, neither one nor many, non-production, and so on, or because it is by nature luminosity. That sounds like a really a happy one to use, right? Thus, one investigates with a sharp weapon of reason and realizes this absence of true existence of the present mind. In this way, when neither percept nor perceiver can be established as anything whatsoever, so the knowledge itself is understood to lack inherent existence. And he gives the same quote, but this comes from the Kashyapa Sutra in the Maharatnakuta collection of sutras. And they all quote this famous thing where the Buddha says, when you understand the emptiness, you use your mind. You have to use your analytical mind to understand emptiness. But then it burns itself up like sticks rubbed together, and it's creating a fire, and they get consumed in the fire.
Your mind gets consumed.
Your mind gets consumed. The conceptuality of the mind gets consumed. As opposed to thinking, concept is terrible, it's bad. You know, don't use concept. The Buddha says you use concepts, and then you burn them, they burn themselves up. You transcend them. But you only transcend them by using them. Let's see. Okay, so then, next page, what happens? The measure of accomplishment. Let's see. Suppleness is attained, which is this Shenjong. Pliancy is the mark of attainment of Vipassana. And until that happens, one only experiences a sort of an approximation of Vipassana. But when it has arisen, one has achieved actual Vipassana. And he says, he talked about this in the Shamatha section, and that's pretty much it. So let's see briefly, let's see what Trungpa Rinpoche says about these.
I have one question.
Yeah.
As this relates to the paths, would the achievement of the Vipassana correlate with any of the paths? It seems like it might be the path of seeing. If you really accomplish it.
Yeah, the full achievement of Vipassana would be the path of seeing, exactly. And so they say that generally one cultivates shamatha in the path of accumulation, and then in the path of preparation, the second path, one cultivates the two, shamatha and vipassana, and then when they're perfected and brought to union, that is the path of seeing in either system, either the object being emptiness or the four truths. It launches off into first this three stages of Vipassana. Which actually comes later in Kongtrul's text. Why don't we peek at that? It's on page 58, if you go back to page 58. Just trying to make it hard for you using electronic version.
Oh, yeah. Great.
first by childlike concentration one perceives signs such as smoke, but a discrimination of phenomena, the sameness of pairs of opposites is realized. Big, small, good, bad, happy, sad, all thoughts vanish into emptiness. And supreme concentration is accomplished. So the root verse, by focusing on suchness, all phenomena seem to be emptiness, which in turn is realized to be peace by nature. There are three stages to the development of this concentration. First, by means of childlike, the mind is slightly withdrawn from external distraction. At this stage, one starts perceiving the 10 signs of empty form, such as smoke, etc. So there's this traditional list of experiences that you have when you start withdrawing from the normal projection pattern that happens in mind. And you may have experienced this in meditation, in intensive practice, maybe on retreat or something where
smoke comes from your ears.
Yes.
That's the most common. I think the more common is like, it feels like your head is like huge or tiny, or your body is huge or tiny, or like the floor shifts, things like this might happen. Anyway.
Or like you smoke too much.
Then by means of the concentration which discriminates phenomena, the illusion of like interdependent manifestations and the total pacification of mental fabrications are realized as one taste. So he gives these very sort of flowery, packaged, well, sort of traditional explanations. We'll see what Trungpa how he explains them. By this, the mind acquires the ability to genuinely rest in the sameness of all pairs of opposites, so that the concentration has now become unmistaken and supreme, therefore one taste. Finally, through the concentration focusing on suchness, one knows all dualistic phenomena to be emptiness. And realizing this emptiness to be by nature primordially peace, the effortless nature is accomplished. So coming back to page 273. On the left hand, starting on the left hand side, first he states the necessity of practicing Vipassana. Without understanding or experience of Vipassana, you can't understand the Four Noble Truths or egolessness. Vipassana is divided into categories. In one system, there's lower and higher. Lower is a shamatha type of Vipassana, meaning it's the Vipassana that was related to the absorption states, based purely on concentration. Higher Vipassana is more inspirational, based on such insights as the Four Noble Truths. In another system, it's divided into two aspects, discriminating awareness, or analytical and immovable. Discriminating awareness is the ability to see clearly and through that clarity develop definite mindfulness practice. Immovability is a kind of absorption in which awareness is constantly present and stable. You cannot move or shift. Different categories of immovability happen in the various stages of Vipassana. Immovability is a powerful experience based on the confidence that you have found the correct path and therefore you cannot forget it. You finally realize that there's no other practice and you've been converted and you have faith in the practice and trust it. So a major aspect is the confidence, trust, and faith in the practice and your experience of it in order to experience it further. Sort of catch 22. But then there's these three stages. First, he calls acting like an infant. In the second paragraph, he says, when you suddenly stop speeding and you become absolutely still, you get a kind of backfire of speed within the stillness. Because you're so confused between stillness and speed, you create visions or hallucinations which do not have any substance. The Japanese people call them makyo. These hallucinations have no root or background. Things shift in front of your eyes. You begin to see smoke passing by. You might begin to have a sense that your toes are gigantic, your body is tiny, or you have a gigantic head and a small body. You might think the ceiling is sinking above your head or your zafu is shifting around under you. your vision changes and all kinds of sounds are heard. Some people hear a complete orchestra with singing and chanting. Different tingling sensations occur in the body. Sometimes there is terror that you don't exist. Such experiences may seem profound, but as long as there is humor at play, I don't think they are a problem. So interesting that he talks about terror or fear of not existing, and the little asterisk, as you see at the bottom of the page, this is when somebody asks what the experience of terror was, he just sat there. Said, I suppose it's like this. I guess he's not too good at imitating terror, probably. The second stage on the next page is called equal taste. A slightly higher stage, a little bit more on the adult level. You begin to experience the Four Noble Truths, and you also begin to experience the simplicity of awareness. So although the sensorial hallucinations might continue, they don't mean anything to you. So you're no longer fascinated by those experiences. There's a quality of one flavor, of one taste. Your shamatha practice continues in a very solid way. You've developed mental stability. So the implication is that the first stage is where your shamatha is a little bit challenged by the experience of vipassana. And then the second stage is when you get used to the spacious quality, let's say, of vipassana, or the disjointed feeling of not projecting existence in the normal way onto things. And your experience stabilizes again in shamatha. Because you're already completely involved with shamatha, you also begin to see the simplicity and straightforwardness of vipassana. At this stage, they are combined. So that combination is the goal of the Burmese meditation schools in particular. But they highly recommend this second category of vipassana as the most important experience. It's interesting.
Is this state similar to the Mahamudra of one taste? Or is that... related.
Certainly seems like it to me. Let's see. The third is called Seeing Things as They Are, which is the Mahavipassana experience. The Mahavipassana experience creates a link between Hinayana and Mahayana, and then you begin to experience emptiness or shunyata. Let's see, skipping a couple of sentences. Because awareness is very direct, precise, and simple, it brings spaciousness and a glimpse of shunyata. You begin to see not only simplicity, which was the experience of equal taste, but emptiness or intangibility. In Mahavipassana, quality of conviction begins to take place, a primitive shunyata experience. So this Mahavipassana experience is a step further than one taste or equal taste, because with Mahavipassana you have a glimpse that you are inherently nothing, not as a meditation experience alone, but as a kind of fundamental devastation. Interesting that he always brings up this sort of psychological experience of emptiness as opposed to the intellectual. In Mahavipassana, there's an enormous feeling of being helped out rather than helped in. You're pulled out of whatever realm you are in. In other words, like you're stuck in your neurosis in your head normally, and gradually through this practice, you're sort of pulled out of that realm, the six realms or whatever neurotic obsession we're in, into a realm or psychological state that's completely empty. You begin to realize you don't have an origin, you don't belong anywhere, you're treading on a path that is a path in terms of experience, but is no longer a concrete path. So there's a lot of fear. So the first first stage of experiencing emptiness is very unsettling, very groundless. And like, what's happening? As if you're riding and you lose your grip on the reins, because previously you had like this very stable experience of shamatha. Shamatha is very grounding and comforting in a certain way, like being here. And then when you start to launch off into emptiness, the experience of emptiness is very, very different shifting, very different shift. Something slowly begins to take over so that the path becomes you. You don't go to the path. Practice becomes constantly apparent. It is your, in your mind all the time, so there's a lot of fear and a lot of concern. Mahavipassana experience can also lead to celebration. On the other hand, it depends on your attitude. If your attitude is that the world is playing a trick on you, you'll complain to everybody. However, if you don't have that attitude of now competitiveness, then realizing there's no ground becomes a source of celebration and joy. At this stage, you have the experience of nothing to hold on to. It's continual, and that experience goes on until a certain level of Vajrayana, and it takes a different form with further sophistication. Interesting little hint there. However, in this case, it's just a simple experience that you exist, but at the same time, you do not have any ground. You have no ground because awareness is constant, and the characteristic of awareness is empty. Awareness does not have a portrait or reflection or identification. So a positive feeling of nothingness becomes very real at the stage of Mahavipassana, or things, seeing things as they are. In this experience of Mahavipassana, it's as though you've been released, like catching a fly thrown out the window. The fly flies away rather than being squashed. The idea of release or liberation in Mahavipassana discipline is to have a glimpse of groundlessness. The basic idea is that the closer you are to your light mind, the most your development takes you in that direction, the more groundless you are. So you're, I think the sense of not being held, not being trapped by your conceptual world, by the structures of our conceptual mind, but being that groundlessness is liberating. Let's see. At the end of the next paragraph, he says, at the Mahavipassana level, you've been introduced to the egolessness of self. And you're just about to be introduced to the egolessness of phenomena, but you haven't actually been completely introduced yet. You just have a sense of it or flow. So interesting that he gives this very lofty experience, but it turns out to be mostly the emptiness of self as opposed to phenomena. And then on the next page, in ordinary language, shamatha is simply the experience of concentration. It's a very different way of characterizing shamatha than he has in most of his other writings. But it's like he's referring to the type of shamatha that Comtrell talked about in terms of the absorptions. Shamatha as a concentrated state. He talks about different types of professions or whatever that could focus on concentration. Towards the end, the last paragraph in the middle, he says, so Vipassana experience and practice is absolutely necessary for the person who follows the Buddhist path and really wants to understand the Dharma. You have to, both intellectually and intuitively, Vipassana is necessary. You have to make an acquaintance with yourself. You have to meet yourself to know who you are and what you are. Without Vipassana, you don't have any idea of who you are, what you are, how you are, why you are at all. And the implication, I think, and in other places when he presents his version of meditation practice, is the implication that if your practice is focused, has a type of shamatha that is extremely concentrative oriented, there's it's sort of like you miss the opportunity to experience the larger sense of who you are, because you're constantly suppressing thoughts, you're constantly eliminating thoughts. And his whole technique involves by having no in-breath, no focus on the in-breath, it intentionally provokes all this stuff to come up. All the neurosis, all the habitual pattern, all of that stuff to come up, which he considers to be so crucial in understanding ultimately emptiness, egolessness, and emptiness.
The shamatha you're talking about, the one-pointed one, that's what the samurais use.
Yeah, right. Yes.
Before battle, so that they could use, one-pointed or kyoshi.
Yeah, for sure. But a lot of other Buddhist traditions do that type of shamatha practice, where it's both breaths and it's like a real concentrated practice. And like our whole, the way that Trungpa Rinpoche presents boredom and the experience of frustration in meditation, where getting just totally overwhelmed by the thoughts, by the endless thought patterns, habitual patterns that come up in meditation, to the point where you're bored with them initially in a frustrated way, and then gradually then turning into cool boredom. A lot of people that do like Theravadin type of meditation practice don't experience that, because they're not letting the thoughts come up. They're continually squashing the thoughts, and so they ultimately, presumably, it goes to the same place, but it's a very different path, where the boredom is what gives, is the actual entree into the experience of Vipassana as awareness. It's beginning to understand awareness, because the boredom is where you're starting to detach from the content. Whereas if you're focused intently on an object, you don't get that experience, at least initially, or directly of detaching from objects while they're still there, from activity, mental activity while it's still there. That happens with cool boredom, where it's like you see the mind doing its thing, but you're shifting into the larger field of awareness.
That seems to be one of the issues in the whole mindfulness movement.
Totally, yeah. Where mindfulness is used, you know, to have that type of sharp precision of mind that Peter was just talking about.
Wouldn't there also be a little difference in using the thinking, the more general thinking label, as opposed to the more narrow, specific things that they do? Like there's a certain degree of
More activities.
Activity, like, and entertainment value of saying, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, and I'm sure they don't mean it to be entertaining, but
it's a way of occupying their mind
right.
More.
So there's more detachment when you just, it's just
whatever it is thinking.
But isn't that what mantra does too?
Well, right, but theoretically it's at a different phase. You've gone through the cool, that process of boredom and experienced open awareness. And so then at that point, Vajrayana has a number of different practices for cutting thoughts. And he very, very overtly says in the Vajrayana, just squashing thoughts. Just cut. And he even explained, I think we saw it, didn't we, recently, but how it's very different than at the beginning stage of meditation.
But how would you describe, from the point of view of John's question, how mantra works in it's different than sort of occupying the mind? Just curious.
It does occupy your mind.
Right.
You're filling up the space with mantra, so you sort of don't let thoughts come into your awareness.
I mean, in terms of the skillful means of it.
But it's not, you're not using the mantra as a way of keeping the psychological habitual patterns at bay. Mm-hmm. Which in the other types of meditation systems, they're using an object to occupy their mind constantly, to develop a strength of mind, and thereby keep the neurosis at bay, keep it out there. But they never process the neurosis. And so theoretically, by the time you're doing mantra practice, you've already gone through a process of seeing your neurosis and getting tired of your neurosis.
Do we know that for sure in terms of what their methods are, or is that sort of are we kind of projecting what they are? When we actually did some of that in that class where we actually tried to apply it, it seemed like there was another aspect of it. It's just like that you could wear out. I'm trying to remember that it, actually experientially, it's like you.
I think they come back to it late, the wearing out of the preoccupation with mind comes later when they go through the stages of insight meditation, and then they experience the fear of formations of mind. They have all those levels of the realization of the insight knowledges. their mind is extremely strong and agile, then they experience the renunciation that we develop through the cool boredom.
So, has anybody actually kind of laid that out? I
mean, no, we've been waiting for you to.
Or is it just what you've come to from your own assessment?
I read it. I wrote it down and I read it.
Where does this movement come from? I'm just curious, like, the mindfulness movement and the insight meditation, where did they come from?
California?
The East. It came from the
East. Why did the mindfulness movement come from
the East? You're right. Why did Bodhidharma come from the West?
Yeah.
Why did John Kabat-Zinn come from
Harvard?
Wherever.
Worcester. Yes. On one hand, it all rides from Millward, but...
Yeah. That's an interesting story, but...
At the end of the night, right?
He
I guess I'll have to go home and Google
he was a Zen. He was into Zen practice, and he was working in this hospital in Worcester, Mass., that was treating a lot of patients with chronic illness, chronic pain, burn victims and other types of victims. And they were giving them tons of drugs and it wasn't really helping. And he thought, let's do a little trial and see if, you know, if we can introduce meditation to people. He had done Zen meditation, which is intense concentration, and it started working. And so they did larger trials, and the initially skeptical staff and administration was fascinated by the results, and they helped promote it. And
who was this?
John Kabat-Zinn.
Back when?
Back in, I think, the late 70s.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's why we now have the evidence-based assessments of mindfulness and meditation, because of things like that, where...
Right, you quantify.
You can sort of satisfy the scientific desire of, you know, to.
But you want, there's a quote by John Kabat-Zinn, which I think outlines this history of how he came to it, using it in like a secular rush, like Western.
Yeah, so I'm just curious.
There's numerous articles too.
Because
sure.
Coming here and learning about Buddhism, and then also coming to how old meditation is as a practice, and I'm just coming to see, oh, there's all these other things going on out there that aren't this, but it's using the mind for something.
When I've done like a couple of presentations at school somehow, and when I researched this, the roots that the people like John Kabat-Zinn say made the ground fertile for what he did was that actually the guy, B.F. Skinner,
Which
you probably know way more than me, but apparently, like, the way to raise children just like 100 years ago was to beat them and to hit them when they cried and to not hold them when they were crying, you know, let them get through the crying.
On the Skinner
babies. This was before Skinner, where it was like, you know, toughen them up. If they're going to exist, if they're going to be able to succeed in this world, they got to be tough.
Yeah, you don't want to raise a sissy.
No. And children were raised that way for, I think, centuries was the implication. And he came along and did a bunch of studies, you know, and found that if children were actually cared, coddled, and provided with tender, loving care, it actually helped them. And believe it or not, that was like radical, this thing, you know, and that created this whole social-emotional intelligence movement that became big in the 60s and started seeping into education, apparently. Just reading, you know, that's what I've read. But, and then that sort of paved the way for this type of meditation, use of mindfulness as being... A type of emotional intelligence to come through, where mindfulness was based on non-judgmental acceptance of whatever arose, instead of, you know, trying to eliminate bad things, just allowing whatever happens, which is his version of mindfulness. His definition of mindfulness is a non-judgmental, presence-centered. A non-judgmental unconditionally accepting present centered attention, something like that. Anyway, we digress. By this merit,
may all obtain admissions, may it be the enemy of wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory.
Thank you. Have a good evening.